when you move the polarity, definitely that somehow affects the structure of the capacitor and the magnet. But the vortex is a motion in its nature, created by that structure that is inside. I was always looking how to make the magnet doing work. When I have two magnets, remember that we were talking about the signals always, we don't deal with work. There is no work being done over there. In here we have a kind of, I don't know if it's clear representation of work in progress because the motion is continuous. Doesn't matter if it's vortex, it's not vortex. It's a motion that is presented in here utilizing steady-state magnetic field.
Dick, if you listen to the audio, the beginning of the audio tells you that it is water, just water, and that's a plastic insulator under that magnet. It's insulated from the metal plate.
Does he explain why the water turns into smoke, John?
No, he doesn't. There's no explanation of that. Just a little bit of explanation about the vortex and the magnetic domains causing it.
To get back to Wesley's question, the usual definition of work is a force being expressed through a distance. If I press my body against the wall of my house and the wall doesn't move, as far as my muscles are concerned, they're consuming energy in order to create that force. They're deflecting the tendons of my body, and my body is doing a little bit of work internally. But on the wall, if the wall doesn't move, I've done no work. If the wall has got some friction between it and the rest of the house, and now I slide that wall by pressing a force against it, yes, I've done work on that wall. So F equals, wait a minute now, force times, a joule is a newton meter. If I apply a newton of force, and while I'm applying that force, the object moves 1 meter, I have created 1 joule of work or energy transfer. So force through a distance gives you work. So two magnets sitting on a table with a sheet of material in between so they can't move and they're attracted to each other, at that instant of time, they're doing no work. Some work was done as I brought the magnets into the vicinity of each other. I'm holding back on the magnets to make sure they don't slam together so fast that they shatter. Let me drop. And during the time that my fingers are resisting the force so that they don't shatter, those magnets are doing work on my body. They're applying a force through a distance. So force through a distance is work. If there's no motion, there is no work. In the case of this vortex, a little bit of work is being done. The magnetic field and the moving charge particles trying to rise got deflected at a right angle. Those individual cloud particles got accelerated in a clockwise or counterclockwise manner. So a tiny bit of work was done on that cloud from my point of view. InterXJN, K2RIW.
That's why I see that as the evidence of, I believe, one of the rare, or maybe the first one in my life, if it's true, of coupling to steady state force of the magnet by means of creating work in any form at this particular situation, that is a vortex. We don't know why it's a vortex. We don't know exactly what is causing the vortex, but it looks like it's a coupling. And to explain,
The evidence to date is that the charged particles of the cloud want to rise. They have a lower density in the surrounding material because they're charged particles moving in a magnetic field. They're experiencing a right angle deflection in a clockwise or counterclockwise manner. So, I could, if I want to, have a steady-state magnetic field, have a pipe of charged particles, kind, gas or fluid, flowing through this pipe, and the particles of, in the pipe are charged, and as they flow through the pipe, the magnetic field will continuously do work on them. So a non-moving magnetic field can create work. It is churning those particles in a certain way. So whether I move a coil or I move particles, whether I move charged particles or move a conductor in the vicinity of a magnetic field, work is taking place.
Why is then that work taking place in form of vortex?
Another way of looking at it, Dick.
Those particles of that cloud, if the magnet wasn't there, they would simply do a pure vertical rise. Because of the presence of the magnetic field, they're forced to move in a helical manner. They have been accelerated in a circle. Although the particles have got very little mass, therefore the total amount of work is very small. Still, work was done on those particles to make them spin in a spiral manner as they rise. The magnetic field did that. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Dick, could you try and analyze it from what I see now as a magnetic capacitor?
The fact that there's a capacitance between the magnet and the metal plate underneath and an insulator in between, the fact that there's a capacitor there, that insulator allows you to put a charge on the magnet. The charge allows you to make those smoke particles with a charge on them. Without charge on the magnet, the particles would just do a pure vertical rise. If he could remove the voltage, in fact he did, somewhere in the movie, he removes the voltage, the cloud does a pure vertical rise. Only when he puts charge on the magnet does the cloud spin clockwise or counterclockwise. Over to you, John.
Dick, if they were to put AC on there instead of DC, now we would have a pumping action between the dielectric, the metal plate, and the magnet, possibly causing that cloud.
By the way, the people who want to see the video that we're talking about, all you got to do is go to youtube.com/WATCH?V=V a whole bunch of uppercase letters. Here they come.
The easiest way is just give the title and they're going to be able to put the title into the window of YouTube.
Good idea. So go to YouTube and type in magnetic vortex spin demonstration. Magnetic vortex spin demonstration. And then you'll see the video we're talking about. You had a question, John. Back to you, John.
No, that was about it, Dick. Maybe RFN would take a look at this if he's still around, and maybe he would have an idea on this. But this is very interesting.
So let's go back to the subject. I would like to discuss that issue that I... Could you go, Dick, to the email that says Revision 1, Revision 1, at the beginning of the title?
I'm going to go back a step and answer John's question. If the voltage put on the magnet was AC instead of DC, then the cloud that's doing the rising, on the positive half of the DC would go clockwise, on the negative half of the DC would go counterclockwise. The cloud is rising slowly. So although microscopically the individual particles would be wiggling back and forth between clockwise and counterclockwise, if the AC was a high enough frequency, you would think the cloud particles are rising purely vertical. That's what I think would happen with AC instead of DC. Does that seem to make some sense? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, that makes perfect sense. Okay, I have enough neodymium magnets. I am going to try this experiment. I'm going to start with DC. I don't know what voltage to use, but I can go up to 5,000 volts. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I'm convinced that 5,000 volts is going to do it. but how are you going to make a rising cloud in the vicinity of the magnetic field? What process are you going to do to make the cloud of particles that want to rise?
I am going to do exactly what this gentleman did. Put the plate in, just touch it with the wire, and see what happens, and then take it from there. Maybe that's all I need to do. I'm totally baffled with this one.
Yeah, but hold on. What's going to make the cloud of particles?
What's making his cloud? I have no idea what makes that cloud. Maybe the transfer of voltage between the magnet and the plate below through that insulator is causing some outgassing. My small brain, that's about all I can come up with right now.
Hold on now. Outgassing of what? He's got a bunch of bubbles on that lower plate. I think that lower plate is under some kind of a fluid. I'm beginning to think the whole darn container is a fluid of some kind. However, the cloud doesn't look like a cloud of bubbles, although it could be. And I do see bubbles forming on the outside of the magnet. But the bubbles on the lower plate lead me to believe that the whole darn mechanism is under a fluid of some kind, John.
Well, he claims it's water. And I believe the bubbles, whatever they are emanating radially from that plate. Where that separation, I think that's where the bubbles are, most of the bubbles start from. Yeah, I saw some bubbles stuck to the sides of the magnet, but they seem to stay there.
Okay, so maybe it's just pure water, and the voltage he's putting on the magnet versus the lower plate is creating electrolysis. And so the cloud is really hydrogen and oxygen gas, very fine gas bubbles.
What causes them to rotate?
They're rotating because they're charged and they're rising. I didn't know that electrolysis would make such fine bubbles. Ordinarily, I think electrolysis makes great big bubbles at the anode and cathode. Over to you, John.
Well, when I've done electroplating, I've seen the bubbles, but I never saw them change their direction. Like, they go straight up. I've never seen this effect at all.
You didn't do it in the presence of a magnetic field.
You're right. I never electroplated a magnet.
Okay, he's doing some kind of a magic to make extremely fine bubbles that looks like a cloud. Huh. I wonder if one of the earlier YouTube gives you introductory material before you see this final one that gives a little bit more of an explanation. And when you look at the words that people responded after the YouTube video, does that give you any clues?
Not really, Dick. But what about some contamination with sodium? Sodium nitrate.
Well,
be there.
He claims that it's a clear water, guys. Not important is what makes the cloud. The important is why is the vortex. That's my suggestion. John can have a experimentation. We're going to find out next week what is the result of it. That will be much more helpful. we can go back to the subject.
Dick has already explained why it's going up in a vortex. Where are the bubbles, and what are the bubbles? That's the key.
By the way, I saw the cloud forming around the piece of wire as he reached into the fluid and was about to touch the magnet. I saw a small amount of cloud on that wire. So just the presence of the voltage on the wire in the fluid is making the cloud. At the instant that he touches the magnet, he's now got a large charged object making a much bigger cloud. That's what I think is partially going on.
All right, this is going to be interesting to see. I'm going to try to set that up, maybe even tomorrow. Wesley, when Dick gets to revision one, that first diagram, we can start that discussion. So we'll finish this one up first.
Okay. Revision 2. No, that was the version 2, but the revision 1. Revision 1 is at the beginning of the title of that email. Revision 1, let me go to the title of it. Hold on. That would be revision REV number 1. REV number 1, material for the technet.
Let's take them a step at a time. Yeah, let them get to revision 1, then explain where you want them to go from there.
Well, I think it's reading the beginning of that email. I would like to start up with part number 2, which is green. With green letters is part number 2, caduces with pickup coil version number 2, flyback connection.
We're going to start with the original number 1 diagram, aren't we? The one that with the output coil. That's what we said yesterday. Now you confuse me.
That's the one. The version 2 is the original one. I already explained to you what is the difference between version 1 and version 2. It's just that the blocking capacitor. So we started with that, which you asked me to prepare with all of the notes. That's the first diagram from the top.
Okay, yes, that sounds right. Not involving the coil capacitor.
Right. Yeah, what you're looking at the beginning of it is a bunch of recognitions and a bunch of endorsements. One of the endorsements is from Dr. Vladimir Yudkin. Then there is an invitation from very much controversial scientist, Dr. Stephen Jones, and he's in 80s, early 90s, his controversy with code fusion. He asked me to work with him, and as you see over there, I was offered financial support and access to the big labs. I'm going to refuse the financial support as I would be in the situation in which I will have to follow a certain agenda of a certain group that is represented over there. Another person...
It's all superfluous. Let's just stick to the subject, the agenda we have going.
So I'm buying the time, John. Dick is reading right now, so I'm buying the time. The professor from Germany who sent me a paper from his university, he's also interested with working with me. I think by that time Dick already found that the first schematic from the top.
Okay, do you want me to read Rev 1? Material for TechNet. Wesley is asking for your help. Watch my material. Is it Rev 1 that I'm supposed to be reading first?
It's correct. You open up this one and go to the first schematic from the top.
Is the first schematic about 5 paragraphs down?
It's correct. It is. It starts on the top of it. You see green letters, part number 2. That will be part found 2. column Caduceus with pickup coil version 2 of Liebig connection.
Just scroll down to the first white page with a schematic on it.
This is not the one by Vladimir Yudkin, Free Energy, Nikola Tesla, Secrets for Everybody. That's not the one you're talking about?
So you have a bunch of links. You have a physical schematic. John, can you explain this better?
Once you got into the Rev 1, Dick, you don't have to do any links. Just scroll down the page. You'll get to a white page with a schematic on it.
Schematic version with C1 JPEG. Okay, I'm looking at that schematic. This Lithuania, Uranus, Lithuania, antenna, Lithuania.
That's not that one. Schematic, if you have a numbers of these schematics, the way that I have it on my email, and John has it in his email, it's one email, and it's the first schematic white page from the top. It is being followed. Right on the top of it, you see green letters. Part 2, colon, Caduceus with pickup coil, version 2 of Liebig connection. And then right underneath of part 2, you see that white page.
I see a schematic with a whole bunch of green labels of people's names and countries on the top. That's not the right one?
But that's not the right one. This one is the second one. We didn't want to discuss that one. The schematic that is... If you go open up this email, you go through the bunch of points and you go down till you see the first you see material for the technet is red. Then underneath you see part one, Eric Dollard, Peter Littleman. You're skipping that. You're going down. And then you see also green, part number 2, Caduceus with pickup coil, version 2 of the flyback connection. And then right underneath of that, you have that white page with the schematic. There is a bunch of lettering on it. John, can you describe how the schematic looks like?
Yes, Wesley. Dick, I think you have to hit your back browser and go back to the original revision 1. Click on that, and then just scroll down on that page that comes up, and you'll see the white page with the diagram right there.
On the revision 1, the very bottom attachment, when I open it, it is a white page, schematic-like diagram, physical diagram. Some of the parts are shown as isometric.
Diagram.
Say again, John?
That's the wrong diagram. I think you're in the wrong... you clicked on one of the links and you got into one of the other links. This is the... It's right on the main page of that revision 1 when you enter it.
Going to any links. You're going to the main page.
Okay. Rev 1... This, the title of the thing that I've opened, which, by the way, was issued on Saturday, 9:18 p.m. Is that the right one?
I'm looking right now at that. It was one day ago. Yes, it was Saturday. I have two forwarded messages, but the revision one is only one. I sent you a few messages, but then I was redoing based on John's request So the revision one is the right one. It's the one that you're supposed to read.
Okay. Was that issued by you on Saturday at 9:18 p.m.?
At 1:09 p.m. on my diagram, December 3rd.
Is yours in Eastern Daylight, Eastern Standard Time, or in some other kind of a clock, John?
That's what's written on the page. Now, maybe Wesley's clock is wrong. It says p.m. It could have been a.m. Excuse me, we were on very late. But I know that if you open up Revision 1, the first thing you're going to see is going to say that forward message from, and it'll be Wesley's information. Then right under that, it has a disclaimer, no matter what you think, Dick, blah, blah, blah. That's the page you want to get on. This is what I mean, Wes, when you send so many things and they're not labeled right, so it's very disconcerting.
Well, I didn't want to really to redo it, but the Glenn said that, don't worry, Wesley. We engineers, we just put revision one, revision two, and everything is clear.
Yeah, but Dick does not have a revision log. You know, I understand what Glenn was saying, but Dick is suffering because it wasn't sent to him just succinctly.
Yeah, I'm sorry for that. But he already found revision one. The email that is revision one and whatever, material for the technet. He opened it up. The problem that he did, he went to the Vladimir Yudkin link, so he was exactly on the page. You're not supposed to enter that link, just go down and write on the email without going to any link. There is that page, that is the first schematic, and the schematic is right on the top of the schematic is in green letters, part 2, Caruso will pick up coil version 2 of Liebeck connection.
Yeah, the diagram should have been sent as a separate email because this is nuts. All right, give Dick a chance. He's looking. He knew to go back on the browser and start all over again.
Of all the things that I've been mailed, Wes, only one of them is labeled Rev 1 material for TechNet, period, colon. Wesley is asking for your help and support.
Yeah, that's the one. Open this one. Don't go to any link. Just go down and right inside the email, you're going to see the first schematic. That's the one.
Is at the bottom of that one, there are 8 attachments. Are you talking about one of the 8 attachments?
No, the way that I have it, I didn't make any attachments at all. What I did is I simply paste and copy the pictures right on the email by itself without any links into it.
Okay, the way I received it has 8 JPEG attachments, 8 pictures, each one of them is a JPEG, and there's 8 of them. Go ahead.
You transmit the file, Wes.
How about if I resend it right now? To Dick, he's gonna know exactly which one. I'm gonna just hold on.
Dick, all the emails you received on Saturday, you should just from Wesley, you should just erase them because they're all wrong.
Yeah, when I open up Rev 1, it has Forward message.
That's the one. Go ahead. Go down.
How far down?
Forward message. Disclaimer. Go down. Green. I do not make any secrets. Go down. Vladimir Yudkin. Go down. Then you see red. The public to the whatever. Go down. Then you see green. Red. Material for the technet. then you see green, part number one, part pound one. You skip it, go down, then you see part number two, caduceus with pickup coil, version two, of live connection.
Nope. I found part two, caduceus with pickup coil, version number two of flyback connection. After that it says image schematic device with caduceus coil and pickup coil, Pamanizui 20% JPEG. It is an indication of an image. The image is not there.
Transmit the file, Wesley. It's like pulling teeth.
I'm a little worried that if he sends the exact same file, I may receive it the exact same way. There may be a degree of incompatibility. When he talks about a green and a red message, I see no colors in the email that I open. And I'm a little bit worried that the incompatibility of my Linux system and his Microsoft system may be such that I get the indication of an image without getting the image itself.
That's possible. Okay. Great. Let's see what happens when he sends the second one.
Yeah, I'm trying to copy that. Copy that.
Because you were able to receive the other images, Dick, so I don't think that's the problem.
Anything I received as an image, it was an attachment that when I opened the attachment, I saw an image.
If you can click on the attachment, see exactly that information about the image. Could you put that information about the image, click at the particular attachment, and by that, you're going to open up exactly that schematic. That schematic has a bunch of text on it. Black text on it, like a handwritten, but it's a print. Maybe you would be able to recognize that. So it starts by Wesley. On the left hand side in the corner, on that picture, you have by Wesley. Left hand side top, by Wesley, in this red.
I've got that image. Upper left hand corner, by Wesley, and the black letters say prepared by Anatoly and so on. And the red below that paragraph says version number two. On the right-hand side, it shows a voltage diagram which looks like a green square wave. And the diagram itself, the schematic, is nice, neat, straight lines.
That's good. Okay. Let me drop and I'm going to start to talk about it.
Okay, we're now both looking at the same schematic. Fire away.
Okay. That shape in green that you see in here could be anything. Could be square, could be sinus, could be a bump, anything like that. It is 200 volts, 150 milliamps, 16.8 kilohertz, which is the resonance frequency of the flyback. Duty cycle is 33 to 38%, and this is crucial. Negative offset. The transformer that we have used is on the left-hand side. You see the terminals 10, 9, and the transformer is TBC 11, 110 LA, which is Russian. Now, that's what you see as the square around it is just a representation for the core, for the ferrite core. The ferrite core has to be grounded. Then that's what you see on the small winding on the right-hand side from the transformer is 3 and 1, which is the input of the transformer. Do you follow so far?
Yes, I do. And the 3-in-1 is being fed that voltage waveform, which is a 200 volt which is being represented as a plus 1 and minus 9. I presume those are scaling factors. That's really a 200-volt square wave with a DC offset. Is that true?
No. Because the transformer works on self-resonance frequency, on terminals 10 and 11, we're getting pure sinus of even amplitude, no ringing.
Okay. If I, before you started running the experiment, if I put an ohm meter between lead number 1 and lead number 3 of that winding, if I put an ohm meter between 1 and 3, make me a rough guess, how many ohms will I read?
Around 1 ohm.
Okay, then you've got a problem. Because the amount of DC offset of that waveform, it looks to me like if that's 200 volts peak to peak, the DC offset is 150 volts. Are you telling me you're putting 150 volts DC across a 1 ohm winding? That's 150 amperes of DC current, and I don't believe it.
Yeah, just reach for that box that I have the transformer in. I'm going to measure it as we speak. Hold on.
If that's a real winding without any series resistance, you cannot put 150 volts across that winding. So the waveform that's shown in green, something is wrong with that waveform. You can't do that.
No, it's not exactly the waveform. It might be wrong with the resistance that I have on it. I'm trying to switch my device and measure that. If it's requested, I really didn't do that before. Okay. And be honest, I didn't measure that, so I don't know. Hold on.
I think it's like 50 milliohms.
Then you ain't going to put 150 volt DC across 50 milliohms without burning up your laboratory, John.
Dick, that is the filament voltage for the rectifier, which I believe in Russia is a 6-volt rectifier. So think of it. We use 383s, 3-volt rectifiers in our high-voltage system. So how many ohms could it be? Which was, and our system was only 2 wraps of a high-voltage wire.
We should talk about the impedance. We're talking about 16.8 kilohertz of resonance frequency. I've done this experiment a few times. I didn't burn anything at all. I have another flyby that I was that I had extended video. John saw it. I was trying to tune that transformer to the self-resonance frequency. I was able to do that. And I ran this kind of experiments before, a year ago. I don't know right now. I'm not going to spend it. We have a few minutes left. This is a point of question. How much really do we have the voltage on it? I mean, not the voltage, the resistance on it. We should not talk about resistance. We should talk about the impedance.
Dick is trying to tell you you have a DC offset on it, which means you have DC voltage on it.
The diagram says 200 volts. And it's got the U, and it's got plus 1 and minus 9. What does the plus 1 and minus 9 represent, Wes?
33% negative offset, that means we're tilting that towards the minus.
Okay, but the U represents voltage, T represents time, 0 is in the center, the horizontal line. What does minus 9 and plus 1 represent when the black lettering says 200 volts?
Okay, I'm going to describe it what I did. You have an even shape of the signal. The same amplitude from the plus, the same amplitude from the bar. Now what we're doing is we simply maneuver the offset down to the minus. So we have a 33 to 38% negative offset. That's what is going on over there. The transformer was dead cold. Nothing was happening. All I need to do is, for the next session, make the measurement. What is the exact impedance or the resistance of resistance of the primer winding 3-in-1.
I've got another guess. If you generated this diagram and you made that green square wave, and the square wave that you drew is only a simplified representation of a repetitive waveform at a 26 kilohertz rate, if it's a representation, but the real waveform is an extremely narrow negative spike with a very broad positive portion to it on each cycle, then I'm going to agree with you. Whenever you feed the winding of a transformer that has low DC resistance, the area above the zero-volt line and the area below the zero-volt line must be equal to each other. So is that a simplified representation, but in reality, it's a very narrow negative spike and a very broad positive waveform on each cycle. Is that possibly what's going on, Wes? K2LAW.
It is possible because in reality I didn't create that schematic. The schematic was created by the guy who, as you say, prepared by Antanas reporter, that guy that was with us. I just took the schematic, redone the schematic my way. I didn't touch the waveform. We used the sort of that was the ramp.
Okay, so that's an oversimplified representation of the waveform. That's not the real waveform. Okay, I'll let you go beyond that point. Go right ahead.
Good point. Yeah, I'm gonna pick it up with IDAS and antennas. Now, terminal 10 and 11. That's the high voltage winding. It is also in simplified form. There was a discussion between me and John about that, but we're gonna pass that. Terminal 11 is one wire connection only. Terminal 10 is connected to the ground through 0.9. So far you're following?
Yes, I am. And now terminal 11 is trying to feed two windings of the ferrite rod transformer, but you're doing it from one winding, and that's a little bit difficult.
Oh. I don't blame you for it. We discussed that in Saturday with Glenn, and finally Glenn decided to give up, and actually not give up. He just said, yeah, I agree with that. Because there was an issue about the capacitor being charged from one wire. He said a closed circuit, then he said the circuit could be closed by electromagnetic wave means as well. John, if you can clarify that.
If there was a stray capacitance between the winding and ground, between any of the leads on that ferrite coil and ground, if there's a stray capacitance, then yes, you can feed it with one wire, and you're feeding it through a stray capacitance as another series reactance. So if this was a pure diagram and there were no missing components...
Missing components is in here.
If this was a pure diagram and there were no missing components, then nothing would appear on that ferrite rod coil. But there's missing components here, like a stray capacitance to ground, I think. Over to you, Wes.
I don't believe so. But I might be in error. In my experiments, I have had a terminal 11 connected to the diodes. One is in reverse. I had a capacitor C2, and I had a light bulb across capacitor C2. That was different experiment. And I remember that I spoke to you over the TechNet, and I showed you that small video, and where you were saying, oh, this is... fluorescent. I say no, it's incandescent, and no, it's not a neon. It's a pure tungsten inside a light bulb. So I remember we discussed that issue before. So with your permission, I want to go further.
Okay, by the way, on the lower right-hand corner, it talks about C1, 2, 3, and 4. Where is C1?
On the lower right-hand corner, you see C1, C2, C3, and C4. Start from the C2. C2 is the capacitor that is on the left-hand side between D1 and D2. The C4 is the capacitor that is on the right-hand side of the pickup coil, in parallel to the pickup coil after the diode. Now, C1 was taking out, for the simplicity, is not important. C1 is the blocking capacitor that is present in that flyback when it's manufactured as the device. Not important here. C3 is the capacitor that could be here. In original experiment, we didn't use that C3. C3 is in parallel, the left-hand side corner to Caduceus. Back to you.
Okay, C1 got removed. I'll stop worrying about it. C3 is shown as 27,200 picofarad, 25 kilovolts. It's shown as a variable capacitor.
Yes, well, the by means is that the way that we were varying the capacitors is by adding the capacitors or minimizing the capacitor or having a variable capacitor. Now, exclude C3. C3 was not used in original experiment. It was just set by IDAS, one of three of us, IDAS, Arunas, and me, that is crucial for this operation. We didn't use C3. Forget about C3.
Okay. I was going to ask you if C3 is variable by selecting different values. If C3 was a completely variable capacitor, I was going to say that's impossible. They don't come as big as 27,000. So I'm going to assume that it was a select-at-test capacitor, but C3 is not there. Okay. Now we're talking about C4, and C4 is that very complicated series parallel network. Go ahead.
C4 is also made from the number of the capacitors just to match the proper capacitance. The most critical capacitor is C2, on the left-hand side next to the two diodes. This one actually makes the shape of the signal that impacts the spark to the point that we have the most efficient light of the light bulb on the right-hand side marked as an output to load.
Okay, I see the 220 volt, 60 watt light bulb right-hand side. And the way the D1 and D2 are set up, you end up with a voltage continuously across that spark gap and therefore on various portions of the waveform out of the high voltage transformer, you get a spark gap operation into the Caduceus coil. I'm getting some idea of that. And also the D3 diode is giving you a continuous DC voltage across the spark gap number 2. And the resultant current through spark gap number 2 is what's eventually flowing through the light bulb. So by definition, that light bulb is getting a very nonlinear waveform. Back to you, Gwen.
Thank you very much. Okay, here's how it works. You give me the right frequency to 3 and 1 of the input. You're getting the voltage from between 10 and 11. From 11, you're feeding two diodes with one wire only. There is no other connection to the ground, as you see. So, by that definition, it is hard to understand how come we could then have the capacitor across the two diodes, spark up that is sparking from one wire only, and then Caduceus coil that is connected on the left-hand side with the ferrite in it. And this structure is able to create any kind of voltage from the other side. if you have any questions in this area so far.
I see how the AC voltage on D1 and D2 produces a voltage across C2. I see how the C2 voltage eventually ends up, because of the DC continuous current on the primary of the Caduceus coil, I can see eventually how that DC voltage appears across the spark gap. When the spark gap does arc, the stored energy in capacitor C2 gets placed across the primary of the Caduceus coil. So I'm beginning to understand that. I see a problem. The problem I see is that high voltage is eventually appearing on the light bulb after spark gap number 2. High voltage on a light bulb is capable of giving a light output of the bulb, which is ionization light, not necessarily incandescent filament light. Ionization light can be more efficient than filament light. So although the light bulb is lighting at full brilliance, it may not be due to the same number of watts input. It may be less than 60 watts input to give you the same amount of light output, because some of it is ionization light, not filament heat light. That's a guess. N2XJN, K2RIW.
The light that I have seen was light that was not really sparking between the legs of the light bulb. It was the light from the filament on it. You say ionization of the gas that is on the light bulb, possibly it could increase the effect, but definitely when you deliver 3.3 watts theoretically to 3 and 1, and you have a 220 volts, 60 watts, which then later, that was 60 watts. At first experiment, we increased it to 100 watts, and then we increased it to 150 watts. In that particular experiment that I was present at, we had a 100 watt light bulb connected in full brightness. That was a regular incandescent light bulb. The pictures, I wanted to add to it, but John insisted don't put unnecessary information. It's self-explanatory. Just put a statement. If there is a need to prove that, you can always do that. Now, on the video that I have made, and I have sent you the link for it, everything is shown step by step, how we do, how we measure, how we wind, and how we assemble the system.
A very difficult measurement to make, that would be very interesting, is the spectral light output of the light bulb. When a light bulb is running in pure filament power, it's probably producing a peak of energy around 340 nanometers, or around 400 nanometers. Yeah, 340 or 400 nanometers. I got it backwards. It's longer. 3,400 degrees Kelvin. The wavelengths of light coming out of the light bulb, when it's fed with 50 hertz, 220 volts, might be very different than the wavelength of light of this particular circuit. I know very few people own instrumentation that can make an optical spectrum picture of the light coming out of the light bulb. But if you did, you might find a very interesting difference. N2XJS, K2LIW.
That's what we're trying to explain. So let's say we stay at the base of what you said right now. 3.3 watts, we have a 220 volts, 100 watts, let's say 100 watts. Full brightness as the effect. We go for better and easier, we go a step-down transformer from the light bulb and try to power it. Or we can use chain of the light bulbs, like carbonized, TK-ed. That was 5,000 watts light bulbs. with similar approach to this one. We tried to follow his concept, although we were not successful with self-looping, so there was not self-sustaining device. Anyhow, blessing job.
Dick, also, what about the temperature? Could measure temperature. There's a big difference between the two different types of lighting that you're talking about.
Good point. So what does the thermometer say? And if you had some kind of an optical spectrum analyzer where you could look at the wavelengths of light versus amplitude, I think you're going to see a difference. Because the light bulb is being fed by a spark gap, and that spark gap is occasionally discharging the voltage on C4, I'm reasonably sure that the waveform on that light bulb is a very nonlinear waveform, a very spiky waveform. Therefore, the light bulb behaves differently. Some of it might be ionization light. See, the way a light bulb is made, a small amount of gas is put inside in order to control the rate at which the tungsten boils off. The light bulb would have a very short life if they didn't put a small amount of... You're not necessarily lighting up the filament. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
You're absolutely right, Dick. I know time is short. That if the element in the glass is glowing red, and you have a... You should not be able to put your hand on a 220-volt, 60-watt lamp. You couldn't hold it on there too long. So that would be one test I would run.
That was correct. Now, Dick, do you have a chance to go to 147 because we're losing the repeater?
No, I'm not going to be able to do that tonight, Wes.
375.
Okay, so we have only the chance to discuss that next TechNet, just because I want to finish the job.
Yeah, I can tell that the light bulb is being lit up by a combination of current flowing through the filament, and I think there could be some ionization of the gas in there as a secondary source of light. And the only way to confirm that, one way to confirm that, would be to measure the wavelength coming out of the light bulb, wavelength versus frequency, amplitude, call it spectrum of the light. Very few people have that instrumentation.